Good evening, everybody. Tonight is lesson 5, the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So help me God. It's on page 93. Just a quick recap of last week. A quick recap of last week. Last week we discussed, the title of last week's lesson was Words That Wound. And we started out with explaining how speech is the defining faculty of the human being. It defines us as who we are. It most differentiates us from other creatures. And in essence, we elaborated how speech is a divine element, as God created the world with speech, so to say. We were given that gift for positive purposes. We then discussed how the concept of speaking evil about another person, speaking negatively about another person, and how it affects not only the person, but it also affects the one who, not only the one who you are talking about, but the person who is talking himself. It affects his character. It erodes the character. And then we took it to the next step, that even crude and obscene words, although they may be harmless, nevertheless, speech affects the character. We discussed how speech, in essence, is a expression of the soul, and a person who talks kindly about others and in general talks in a kind fashion, it's an expression of the soul. And the opposite, someone who speaks crudely or badly about other people, it's an expression of who he is. And we discussed how obviously a person who has that issue should focus on the positive way of changing. There's two ways of approaching a negative trait. One is to focus on how bad it is and how terrible it is. Then the other way is to focus on how positive and how good it is when you don't engage in that negative behavior. For instance, the fact that if a person truly loves other people, truly respects other people, then that person will not speak negatively about other people, will only want to find and speak about the positive elements. And then we ended from a halachic, from a Jewish point of view. The Jewish law discusses certain times when you are allowed to divulge information about other people, even though it may be negative, and that is only if there is a third person who will be negatively affected. Right? We discussed that medical issue where a doctor, for instance, knows about a certain tumor in a young man's brain, and he decided not to tell the young man because he was afraid that telling this young man would affect him negatively and would even shorten his life. So he subsequently finds out this young man is engaged. Does he have a responsibility to tell his future bride that this man only has 2 years to live? And we ultimately came to the conclusion that he does have a responsibility, because you cannot stand idly by. If you have information that will affect a third person, you cannot just stand idly by, even though it will obviously have a negative impact on the person upon whom you are revealing this information. So tonight, we're going to... Yes?
If that's a person, tell him how he is. And if it is a hopeless situation, and you are his friend, would you tell him that it is hopeful?
We're talking, that's in our lesson. That is precisely one of the cases that's in our lesson tonight. Because that's about, are you allowed to tell the truth or part of the truth, and what really defines truth? That's precisely one of the cases we're going to be talking about tonight. Well, when the truth hurts, can you still say it? That's the question. And we're gonna discuss that tonight. But that's precisely the point of tonight's lesson. Let's start with the introduction. Tonight we're going to start from the left side. Ruby, please. Page 93.
The divine seal, the sages tell us, is emet or truth. Yet in a world in which good and evil must coexist, an unwavering devotion to truth may seem naive, even counterproductive. How are we to discern its correct application and decide when honesty really is the best policy?
So we often say that honesty is the best policy. It's a famous saying. We've been raised with that concept, always be honest. Our parents tell us honesty is a virtue by which you should lead your life. That's what we've been taught in school by our parents, by our teachers. And we speak about unkind truths, hard truths, naked truths. There's all different types of truths. And ultimately, in the society we live in, if somebody is always going to tell the truth, irregardless of the situation in which he or she finds herself or himself in, we know that person will not last very long. It's just the way it is. You can't. If every single thing in our society, you are always saying the exact truth, right? If your wife wakes up one morning, she doesn't exactly look, you know, in her finest, and you get up and you tell her how she looks. Obviously, that marriage is not going to last long. If a business partner shows up one day and he's not in his best performance, and you're the first one to jump on him and point it out, obviously that business relationship is not going to last long. Society we live in, that is the fact. You can't always be telling the naked truth every single time. On the other hand, sometimes we should be saying the truth and we don't. That's just the way human beings are. So tonight's lesson is going to be devoted to analyzing when the truth must be absolute and when we must always, when we're obligated to always tell the truth, even if it's difficult, and when withholding the truth will be the best course of action. In many situations, Judaism agrees that withholding the truth is the course of action that should be taken. And we're going to discuss the various scenarios. We'll start with our video of the evening.
How honest are you? Under what circumstances would you be willing to bend the truth? Would you lie and say that you graduated summa cum laude from an Ivy League college to land a dream job with a top law firm? Would you lie about owning a cat in order to rent an apartment with a no pets policy? Would you lie to keep a friend from finding out about a surprise birthday party? Would you lie to keep a sick man from knowing he was dying? Is there a difference between a self-serving lie and a lie to protect others? Kant thought honesty was a categorical imperative, an absolute that could not be bent under any circumstances. He would argue that if a Nazi came to the door to ask a homeowner if there was a Jew hiding in the basement, the moral man would have no choice but to speak the truth. Judaism has no such qualms. While in a perfect universe, one would speak only the truth, it knows that in the real world, truth must sometimes be bent so that people are not unfairly harmed. Yet are there contexts in which a lie is never justified, even if one's intention is to do justice? We all recognize that courts depend upon people to tell the truth in order to ensure that justice is done. Can it ever be ethical to lie before the court in order to ensure a just outcome? Can one lie for the sake of the truth? Can you tell the difference between a black lie and a white lie? And can you distinguish between various shades of gray? Join us for Lesson 5 as we explore the circumstances under which Judaism demands that we must tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Every day of our lives, we are faced with difficult ethics.
That's a repetition of every week, right? You want to see the rest of it?
Yeah.
Huh?
Yeah.
That's they do the same thing every time. Oh, okay.
How honest are you?
Oh, 1 second. No, we can't.
Under what circumstances would you lie and say that you graduated from an Ivy League college to land a dream job? Would you lie about owning a cat in order to rent an apartment? Policy. Lie to keep a friend from finding out about a surprise birthday party? Would you what was done? Difference between a self-serving lie lying to protect others. Kant's imperative, an absolute.
We're getting there.
He would argue that if the door to ask the homeowner basement, the moral man would have no choice, truth. Judaism has no such qualms. Truth that in the real world, truth be bent so that people are harmed. Yet are there contexts in which a lie is never justified, even if we all recognize that we tell the truth in order to ensure this is done. Can it ever before the court in order to ensure a just outcome? Can one lie for the sake of the truth? Can you tell the difference between a black lie and a white lie? And can you distinguish between various shades of gray? Join us for Lesson 5 as we explore the circumstances under which Judaism demands that we must tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Every day of our lives, we are faced with difficult ethical dilemmas. We grapple with a wide range of problems, the subtle and the complex, the personal and the communal, the mundane and the spiritual. The Talmud provides guidance to help us navigate these choices. Talmudic Ethics, finding your way to good decisions.
Good evening. Movie night. So we're going to start with an activity. And everybody has pens and papers in front of them. We're going to fill out this chart. And then I'm going to go around the room and I'm going to ask, or at least in peers, right? Let's go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Let's pair up with the person next to you. And then I'm going to go around and I'm going to ask you to you know, basically give me a quick rundown of why you answered your specific answer. So the first question is it right to lie in order to get hired by a firm suspected of polluting in order to gather evidence? You're going to become an undercover agent for PETA. Is it always okay? Is it usually okay? Sometimes never. Next one, keep one's landlord from knowing you have a cat, so on and so forth. So take it away. Discuss it between yourselves.
Yeah.
should go to another place and said you can't have sex.
Okay, are we ready? We there? We've arrived? Not yet?
Is the criteria whether you're caught or not? So what about the sometimes?
That's a great film. So. Together. The purpose of this exercise was to enable us to answer the questions on the board. I think by going over these 9 various scenarios, we all now have a better understanding that lies come in different flavors. There's no such a thing as an absolute lie. It doesn't exist. So let's answer these based upon this exercise. Let's look at the board. Which lies are always justified? Well, let's flip that on its head for a second. How about if you don't tell a lie, you'll harm somebody?
Don't have a heart attack when there's a problem.
Exactly.
Depends on the person.
Can we come to consensus where everybody in this room would agree under certain circumstances it's always justified to lie?
Under certain circumstances?
Yeah.
Yeah.
When?
Probably true.
No, you can't have a hard and fast policy.
say if a person is going to be seriously hurt by a certain truth, could everybody in this room agree that it would probably be best to lie? Correct? If somebody's going to get hurt, it's not right. In other words,
the lie does not create any
well, obviously, if a lie is going to create a bigger problem than the current one, then that's a separate issue. But we're talking about a situation where by saying a lie you will avoid seriously hurting another individual, and I think everybody in this room would agree that's okay.
No,
which
more
we're gonna discuss certain situations further on in the class with more detail.
Someone's cheating on their wife.
Right.
You don't want to say anything.
Well, how about here's another scenario. How about if somebody? But how about if there's no way that anybody will ever find out about it? Good evening.
Good evening.
Join us, please.
Yes. Late, but here nonetheless.
That's good. How about we're discussing the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth. Actually, we're not too far into the lesson. We're on page 95. How about which lies are never justified?
The ones that aren't keeping a cap that do more harm.
Or self-serving, for absolutely a self-serving lie.
Yeah.
In other words, for no reason, no benefit whatsoever. You're just lying, no benefit. There's no benefit, there's no good that's going to come out of it. It's just a self-serving lie. Everybody would agree that's never. Can you formulate a rule expressing when lying would be the more ethical choice and when it is definitely wrong?
The
case with the Nazis, right?
Yeah, but what's the rule?
Well, what's the rule? No, it's not a specific. In other words, what would we formulate the rule? If we had to determine a rule that, based upon this rule, we either a lie would be justified or would not be justified, what would be that rule?
I mean, if you want to get really broad, for the really broad brush, I would say justified when it does good, and not justified when it does bad.
Okay, so basically.
Well, what's good? Here's an example we all face all the time, especially in this highly policed city. You either have to take it for X number of miles over a limit, or going over the LOI, or something like that. And maybe you're not sure, or maybe you know you were over 5 minutes. Or maybe you know you were 5 minutes, or 5 miles fast. What do you do on your written declaration, if you're going to do it in traffic court, written declaration, or in court itself? Technically, you know, what is it? Is it perjury? If you know absolutely that maybe you crossed the line, or you're going 5 miles fast, or if you're not sure, or it's just your opinion, or if you're just ticked off and think it's a petty cheap shot by the officer.
I would say don't give a declaration. You don't. That's not the way you want to stop it. Take it anyway. you would. I mean, you have rights to cross-examine the cop, the witness, but you don't have to. You don't have to give a declaration.
Well,
in that situation, you don't have to say a lie. You can omit. You say, I'm not going to say one way or the other.
Well, they have trial by declaration.
I know.
That's a good case. That's a perfect case scenario. In other words, what do you do? So ultimately, we have to have a certain. The question in number three is, what would be the rule? In other words, how could we formulate a rule that if a person is faced with a moral dilemma, should I lie or should I not, what would the rule be to either go towards lying or veer against it? And I think from what we've been discussing till now, a lot of it revolves around if another person will be hurt or not. In other words, the element that has to be paramount is somebody going to get hurt? Is this going to be a positive in bringing peace between two people, say, or not?
Well, how does that come into a traffic citation?
So that's a whole separate.
Somebody can be yourself.
Somebody can be yourself too. And if you feel.
Are you filling out that citation under the penalty of perjury? Not the citation, but if you're not under the citation, the declaration.
Yeah, the declaration would be under penalty of perjury.
That answers
the question. Well, it doesn't matter because maybe you're not sure. Maybe there's some gray area. Did you cross the line? Are you really sure? Did you go 5 miles over the limit, or what, you said 10 miles?
Well, if you're not sure, then you can say you're not sure.
If you're not sure, then there's no reason that you have to take the officer's word for something that obviously he may be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
There's no need for
okay.
it. And don't forget, there's a penalty on your side, so it costs you $300. That monetary fine hurts you. So the question is, if he's not sure and you're not sure, then there's no reason why you should be the one.
Well, he's sure, because that's why he can't do anything.
But he's human, just like you are.
But the presumption is
Jewish.
So I have a question.
Yeah.
You've been in a car accident and the police come and says some false mistake. You know you hit the person that's gonna cost you $3,000, so it's gonna hurt you. Not the
wife,
but it's hurting the
other person too. Oh, but here we're not talking about there's another person that's going to get hurt. The officer gains nothing or loses nothing by the fact that you dispute his.
They have to meet
a bullet. Huh?
They have to meet
a bullet. I don't know.
No,
I don't
because
believe
that. They don't give all they want now.
Whereas in the situation you're describing, the other person is at fault, their insurance is going to go, it's going to hurt them. So then you probably could not lie. You have to be honest. Okay. We're gonna talk. We're gonna get to that in a second. But let's move on. Let's for a second go to segment B, and we're gonna compare the American versus Jewish legal system. Erwin and Mort can obviously elaborate a little more and a little better about this than I can. But the American legal system is generally adversarial in nature. In other words, it's based on the belief that justice will most likely be achieved via a process that is common in our courts, which is you have the defense and the prosecution. The defense, the general rule is that the prosecution, right, their responsibility is to make the case for guilt, whereas the defense attorney, his responsibility is to defend the client even if he thinks his client is guilty. He still has a responsibility to defend his client, and the judge as a rule is meant to be impartial. He generally does not weigh in on the specifics of a case unless he feels that either side is really getting out of hand. But generally a judge is sitting there to be convinced, just like the jury and just like everybody else. You got to convince the judge as well. That's generally the way our civil legal system is based. And the reason, the problem with that, first of all, is that it doesn't require the attorney to be truthful. Again, his responsibility is his client. And he has to present the case first and foremost in such a fashion that will protect his client. His first objective is not truth, it's defense. And that's what our legal system requires
Isn't
of him.
A flaw in the system?
It's that is a slight flaw. The reason behind this is in order to ensure that even unpopular members of our society are presented and get a fair trial. In other words, that everybody should get due process. That is the reasoning behind the American legal system. The adversarial system is ultimately structured in such a way that minimizes the chance that a defendant will be convicted of guilt. In other words, often, even somebody who is generally perceived to be guilty can easily walk away if he has a skilled lawyer or a bad prosecutor. Either or will tilt it in his favor, and our system is really tilted towards in such a fashion that favors the defendant. That's the way our system is. Again, because we want to give everybody due process. The Jewish system, on the other hand, is very different. The Jewish system revolves around the judge. The judge ultimately is the one that has to make the final decision, and he's the one, again, we never have one judge. We're talking about a minimum of 3 judges, or 23 judges, or 72 judges. And they serve as the jury. They serve as the as the judge, they're the ones that ultimately have to decide. And they have to determine on their own, based on the facts. The facts are presented by the witnesses, and based on those facts, they have to come to a conclusion. Often, a judge, if he senses that a witness or a defendant is being is an incredible liar and is presenting the case wrong, a judge has to go against what is deemed to be rock-solid evidence and decide on the merits of what he feels the case has, or lack thereof.
I have a question then.
Yeah.
In light of what you just said, so in a Jewish court of law, would you have advocates?
They do. We do have a system, but again, the advocate generally is there to present not the case per se, but to present the legal understanding.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, whereas a typical lawyer will argue on the details of a specific case,
mm-hmm.
right? And he will argue on a prosecution's side of the case. In other words, he will sit in front of a jury and say, the prosecution said so-and-so happened, I'm going to say that really it didn't happen. Who said it happened? And he'll present an entirely different story. In a Jewish court of law, that's, you can't do that. The facts are presented by the witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
An advocate or a lawyer can now decipher or can expound based on Jewish law. Can say, well, based upon the facts that we have, Jewish law says this, Jewish law says that. And then
interpretation
of how, exactly. So in other words,
facts.
you can't, right. And the judge sitting there has to decide determine what it is. So let's go to text one. We're only on text one. Wow. We got to catch up. Page 95.
He
doesn't weigh the evidence.
He presents. Once the witness has presented the fact, he's weighing what he is.
He presents law. Yeah, the advocate presents the law.
Say which one he believes the more, who's more credible, and then he applies the law to that.
He doesn't apply. It's not that he applies the law. What happens is they bring the facts. Okay, you have witnesses.
And when the facts aren't all lined up,
we can only deal with what we have. Right, the facts are based on witnesses. If you know, as we discussed last week, if there isn't witnesses, there's no case.
But there is a conflict between two witnesses.
The two witnesses, in order to convict somebody, two witnesses have to cross-examine the witnesses. That's part of the process. We cross-examine the witnesses separately to make sure that they have the same story. Say it's a capital case, right? Somebody is accused of murder. There's two witnesses that saw it. We bring the two witnesses in, we cross-examine them separately, and say that now we're convinced that they're both saying the truth. So now the advocate comes in, and he starts saying, well, can we convict him of murder or not? Assuming that the witnesses know what they're saying, right? We cross-examine them separately. Can we convict him of murder or not? So now he starts bringing down case, right? Cases from say the Talmud, where in a situation maybe there was duress. If there was duress, then he has to bring the cases that are applicable to duress. Maybe he was insane. So if he was insane, they have to bring the cases. They have to bring the various laws that are applicable to insanity. And after everybody hears everything, ultimately it's the judges, right? With a murder case, it's a minimum of 23 that determine what the outcome is.
What happens when there's variances in the facts as they're presented by the witnesses?
If there are variances in the facts as presented by the witnesses, then we have to throw the case out, because that means that they both didn't see the same thing. If one said that he was wearing a white shirt, another one says he was wearing a yellow shirt, then how could we believe them? Their story has to match up. If the story doesn't match up, then there's no case.
It matches, but this is variance.
Okay, so I guess the judge then has to decide.
That's what I'm saying.
Which variance. The judge then has to decide which variance. In other words, if it's a variance.
So the judge presents to the advocate
exactly.
the facts.
Right. He has to say, look, this is a variance. Maybe it was dark, and the difference between yellow and blue was indiscernible, so we're going to have to overlook that little variance. But the fact that everything else, we have a walking cup. But the fact that everything else is alive. Who's underneath it? But the fact that everything else lines up, then we're going to have to move forward with the case. Right. Laura? No.
Hi.
You, right. Again, we're talking about ethics,
right.
Morality,
right.
And therefore we're analyzing it, assuming that the morals of the of Judaism is something that we.
Right. No, I'm saying I understand a Jewish legal system. I'm saying, is there such a thing like ethics, Judaism?
Oh, there is. Yeah, it's arbitration. It's acceptable here in the U.S.
Oh, that's.
Yeah, you go to arbitrary court, which is the Bet Din, and then you come back to the court and they enforce it. And there's a certain strength to it. Actually, a lot of non-Jews, interestingly enough, use a Jewish court of law when it comes to monetary things, because there's no system of appeals. It's final. It's much cheaper for many corporations. So it's, and I read that they had this whole article, I believe it was in the Wall Street Journal like 2 years ago, about a lot of firms that non-Jewish at all, and they're going to Jewish courts of law for arbitration. Why would they do that? It's much cheaper. You go to court, the court agrees that you can go to a Jewish court of law. The court of law decides quickly, right? It's in a few days. And then they come back and the court has court enforces it and there's no appeals.
Rabbis?
They have here in Los Angeles, there's one in New York, there's a few of them.
Rabbis are judges also?
They're judges, yeah. They're the rabbinical judges. And it's legally binding arbitration.
And they rule based on the Talmud?
Yeah, absolutely.
Based on,
yeah. Nope.
Not based on American.
Nope.
No,
they use based on Talmudic logic.
I saw a show where.
This
is good. I'm glad I signed up for this.
I'm in a conference with you, and in the conference you say,
yeah.
If we have any dispute, we will go to court as an arbitrator.
Right.
And accept his arbitration. He does not have to be a lawyer, he does not have to be a rabbi, he does not have to be a judge. Any arbitration.
I think there are certain arbitrary courts that are enforceable. I think there's a system. Mort actually is an arbitrator, don't you? No?
I know somebody who's an arbitrator, but she is an attorney.
Right.
Like
Erwin, you wanted to add something?
Doesn't have to be attorney.
No.
How does the Israeli law or Israeli courts, do they use the
no.
system?
No, no. Israeli is system is a secular system. It's not based on Jewish law.
Is that right?
Yeah. Although, for major things within, say, the life cycle of an Israeli, the rabbinical courts, let's say marriage, divorce, burial, these things are determined by the rabbinical courts.
Do both sides have to agree, or can one side in the lawsuit just say, I will only be judged by a Jewish court? Like if somebody's suing
both
me?
Both sides have to agree.
Yeah, because you still have to follow the laws of your country.
Okay, let's move on. We're not going to get too far if we don't read.
So, on page 95, you
know. Yeah, Steve, 95, text 1.
If a judge feels that a witness is deceptive, he should not say, I will decide the case based on the strict principles of the law, and let the blame for the possible injustice fall upon the witness, for it says, you shall distance yourself from falsehood.
In other words, based upon what we just said before, that is that we believe that the truth is more likely to present itself and to emerge through a judge directly cross-examining the witnesses versus having, and the defendant's story, versus having a system of a defense lawyer and that can ultimately make or break a case because their whole case, and oftentimes it's based upon the skill of, as I mentioned before, the defense lawyer or the lack of skill on the side of the prosecution or vice versa. As you know, many times you have court-appointed lawyers and they pull people out of the woodwork who wouldn't be able to make a living on their own, and these are the people that end up defending, you know, people on death row. It's unfortunate, but this is, and then, you know, murder cases are often being prosecuted by the skilled of most skilled of prosecutors who are trying to get up the political ladder and, you know, get another notch under their belt in order to run for attorney general or something. So obviously, it becomes obvious that in a situation like this, the truth doesn't always come out. Let's go to case study number one, on page 96. And this is by Rabbi Ovadia Yosef, who actually is still alive. He was the previous chief rabbi of Israel.
I'm a member of a group of three judges who are involved in arbitrating a monetary dispute between two members of our community. My view differed from my other colleagues in the Beis Din. Thus, the majority of opinions seem to be leaning towards a position which I felt was utterly mistaken. I feel that by bringing in more judges, the case will gain from the input of the additional judges, hopefully leading to a just verdict. Is it right for me to be deceptive and say that I don't have an answer in order to force the other members to invite two more judges?
So, as you can see, we're going to answer this question at the very end of tonight's lesson. But basically, is he allowed to lie in such a situation? The first thing we have to do now is we're going to go to section.
We have that in American jurisprudence right now.
Right.
They shop judges.
Let's go to section two. We're going to define honesty. First, let's talk about what lying is and how do we define lying? Is it mainly about deceiving others? Is it about semantics? Is it about using deceptive words? What exactly is lying? And what should be the main criterion that is considered to be a lie? So let's look at learning activity number two on page 97. So let's do this. Let's do it together. Let's go through these cases. If someone is delusional and tells outlandish stories, would we consider that person a liar?
No.
If I tell a joke and everyone knows that I'm joking, is this a lie? I visit a new town and tell people my name is Harry. Really, my name is Joe. No one is harmed by this lie. They do not know me. I'm not concealing a past nor impersonating anybody. Is this a lie? He's not delusional.
Well, it's technically a lie, but it's a harmless one.
So, but is it a lie?
Yeah,
it's a lie.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, good. So far, you're batting 100 for 100. A teacher accuses a student of not having studied for a test. The student, in a hurt and sarcastic voice, answers, "Of course I haven't studied. I haven't spent even 1 minute looking at the material," thus implying by her tone that she has been misjudged. In fact, the student has not studied. Is that student lying?
Yeah.
No, no. Her tone.
Well, her tone is lying.
She said the truth, but her intent was...
Her intent was deceived, and
deceived.
It's not just
so
word,
the ultimate,
the
right, so the ultimate, I think the thread that ties all these different cases together is if the intent is to deceive, that's a lie. Regardless of what you're saying, if the intent is not to deceive, it's not a lie. So in case number one, there's no intent to deceive. Obviously the person is delusional. Case number two, there's obviously no intent to deceive. Case number three and four, however, there's clearly an intent to deceive. Whether or not it's harmful, and number three, there's no harm coming out of it, but this person is trying to deceive other people. That will be considered as a lie. Same as in number four, even though the person was saying the truth, but by saying the truth, she was trying to deceive her teacher. That, in essence, is a lie. So now that we...
What about in the play of the importance of being earnest? It's still,
if you're trying to deceive, deception is the ultimate litmus test of whether or not it's a lie. So let's look now in section B, deception as the core of lying. Let's read on page 98.
Text 2.
Yeah.
God is morose, those who speak one thing while another thing is in their heart.
Right. If you look on the board, there's something called Echad Bepeh and Echad Belev. Judaism is very pro the concept of saying one thing and believing it in your heart. That was the opposite of deception. Someone who's trying to deceive another will have one thing in their heart and will say something entirely different. So duplicity is ultimately forbidden, even in a situation where no harm will come out of what you're saying. Just by the fact that you're deceiving another person, in essence, is wrong. Even to, I don't know, that's a different story. We're going to get to that. That's a whole different story. Text number 3. So this is Maimonides. So he basically says that regardless of whether another whether there's harm intended, that just deceiving or even shades of deception is wrong. So now we're going to go to section 3. Why tell the truth? Why is it so important? Why does Judaism stress the importance of being truthful and not deceptive? So as you can see on the board, the foundation of our society is the ability for people to trust each other. When people lie, they ultimately manipulate our decisions by giving us false information. And the more accepted lying is, the harder it is to function as an effective society. As you know, you look at many countries around the world, the more bribery that is found in that country, the more graft that is found in that country, the less societal structure that you'll find in that country as well. In America, by and large, of course, we do have this, you know, every society has a problem. By and large, it's a country of law. Bribery does not work. If a cop pulls you over and gives you and is giving you a ticket, you try to give him $100, you know where you're going to end up. However, you get pulled over in Moscow and you give a cop $100,
yeah, no problem.
He's going to be... you'll never get a ticket for the rest of your life. I mean, you know, it's a whole separate story.
Even
so,
if you don't break the law, they will stop you
because they want to bribe.
Exactly. So as you so basically the concept of being truthful is central to a functioning society. Even there are philosophers that state that the foundation of civilization is the presumption that other people generally speak the truth. That is the foundation of society. Let's look at text number 4, which is from Francis Hutcheson, who was a philosopher, one of the founding fathers of the Scottish Enlightenment. Text 4, Laura, please. So as you can see clearly, for a society, for a functional society, we need to trust each other. And in order to trust each other, people have to tell the truth. But even on a personal level, even just for the person themselves, saying the truth ultimately forms a person's character. It forms a person's character in a positive way. Let's look at text 5. Well? Go ahead. You got it.
Thus is the life of the deceiver. Even when he speaks the truth, he is not believed.
I know why you took that one. You want to make sure that Adam gets the long one. Text number 6. I'm just kidding. Adam, go ahead. So as you can see, speaking the truth ultimately affects a person themselves, because other people will trust you if you speak the truth. However, if you're a deceitful person, over time people will generally gravitate away from you, will look at you as dishonest, and will not believe you anymore, and ultimately you become a non-functioning entity within the society you live in. It's just a fact. Text number 6.
Lying can cause quarrels, strife, murder, vain oath, and many other transgressions. All these evils stem from speaking falsehood. Therefore, the Torah says, distance yourself from lying, and immediately it states, do not kill the innocent with the righteous. This instructs us that lying is killing them. Therefore, happy is the person who distances himself from them and trains his mouth to speak truth, humility, and right. Through this, he will attain his desire.
So, Ellie, what do you...
Well, it's supposed to be a tulip. People will believe you and tell you lies. Sometimes it's inside the people lie who don't know this and that live in the country.
That's also true.
But politicians cannot tell the truth.
They're exempt from all this.
That's so right in the job application.
I read it. You know, ultimately, it's a good question. Politicians, if you think about it, you know, there's a famous statement, how do you know a politician is lying?
Lips.
Lips are moving, exactly. So, you know, I think that it's the very definition of a politician's job to lie. If he tells the truth, people still think he's lying, right? When a politician gets up and starts talking the truth, you think he's delusional. Then he goes back to the case of a delusional person, right?
This boils down to the fact that a lawyer in a court of law is not accountable if he lies.
Well, he is. Technically, he's accountable for lying.
But if he lies,
his first responsibility is to protect the defendant. In other words, if the prosecutor says white, he has to say black. Prosecutor says black, he has to say white. He has to refute the prosecutor. That's his job. That's a lawyer's job.
This law is so basic. The American justice system is called politics, the justice system, etc.
It's looked at as a problem from a Jewish standpoint. It's looked at as a definite problem. And
so many Jewish lawyers.
Right. Maybe that's why there's so many Jewish lawyers. So until now we've been discussing, right, the fact that telling the truth is important for society, telling the truth is important for an individual, and finally we're going to go to point B, which is honesty as a godly virtue. Judaism takes this concept of honesty to a far greater length. It says that we have a responsibility as human beings, we're created in the image of God. In essence, we have godly powers, and we're required to emulate God. As the Torah tells us, God is compassionate. Human beings are supposed to emulate God and be compassionate as well. It also says God is truthful. And because God is truthful, we have a responsibility to be truthful. So in essence, Judaism is telling us that our ability to connect to spirituality, our ability to connect with the divine, is dependent upon making these spiritual connections. And one of these spiritual links is honesty. Just like compassion is a spiritual link, honesty is a spiritual link. So more than just being critical to society, more than just being critical for your character, it's critical for a human being to connect to the divine. Honesty is a critical component of the ability for a human being to connect to the divine. Let's read a little more about this concept on page 100, text 7. More, please. You'll do text 7 and 8.
The seal of the Blessed Holy One is true.
A seal generally is a symbol of identification. It's used to identify an individual. As you know, in the days of old, when you sent a letter, you put your seal on it. Your seal basically was who you were. A closed seal meant that something was delivered untarnished from its author to the person who wanted to deliver it. So it, in essence, saying that this is the seal of God, saying that this represents God. God's very essence is represented by the concept of honesty and truth. Let's look at text 8.
The root of this mitzvah is that falsehood is repulsed by all. There is nothing more objectionable than lying. Those who love the quality of falsehood are not eligible for its blessings, for he is true and everything about him is true. His blessings can only be bestowed upon those who emulate him in their actions, that they be truthful just as he is true, and to be compassionate as he is, etc.
So, one who fails to emulate in God's ways, in essence, is also destroying that special relationship we have with God. Because if this is the link that connects us with the divine, by violating that link, we're not able to follow through with our connection with the divine. As you can see in text 9, Regina.
What does the prophet say that the Lord is the true God? Means that only God is everlasting and that nothing else is. Which says the Torah has said there's none else besides Him. Namely, the free is nothing in existence but the everlasting effect of God. But there is nothing in existence but everlasting effect.
So, truth in its absolute meaning is eternal and unchanging, right? Thus, therefore, one second, let me back up. God in essence is eternal and unchanging. And because truth is His very symbol, therefore in essence, truth becomes an element that is eternal and unchanging. And it's a mainstay of a human being, irrelevant of what situation they may find themselves. It's something that must always be protected and shielded. We're going to get back in a second to situations where we obviously are meant to bend the truth, because that is the ultimate will of God. But now we're talking about what is truth, and why Judaism places such a strong emphasis on this concept of truth and honesty. And ultimately, as we mentioned before, that truth represents the cornerstone of a functioning society, so too truth represents the cornerstone of the very creation. And by undermining that cornerstone, in essence, you're undermining the very creation itself, the very purpose for which our world was created, which is for the purpose of, and we'll see in the next reading, Mishnah Avot, which is Pirkei Avot, mentions that the world was created to stand on three pillars. And the three pillars, again, this is both spiritual and physical, is represented by, let's look at reading number 110 on page 102. Michael, you also get the next one.
The world endures by virtue of three things: justice, truth, and peace.
The Judaism in a nutshell says that these are the three things that if we honor them and follow it, the world will stand both in a physical sense and from a spiritual standpoint. If we don't keep these and cherish these three fundamental elements, then the world in essence is being eroded from the inside. It leads to the erosion of the world. Justice, truth, and peace. So now we get back to one of our original questions, which we started out with this course. So do you always have to tell the truth? We just went through this whole Megillah, so to say, of many different readings from different, you know, from the Torah, from the Talmud, from the Maimonides, about how so very central and so very important to our very existence truth is. Do we always have to tell the truth then? Should the truth be absolute in every situation? You must tell the truth, otherwise we're undermining, heaven forfend, the very creation. We're undermining the very moral fabric of society. How could you ever lie?
Well, truth is only one of the pillars. There's justice and there's peace.
That's true. But a two-legged creature is not as good as a three-legged one.
Yeah. Well, I'm just saying.
But again, we're saying how fundamental truth is. Is there ever a situation where you're allowed to lie?
Yeah.
And the answer to that, we're going to read right now. There are
It doesn't say three equal things.
It doesn't say three equal things. Exactly.
Yeah, and
what we're actually going to head towards is that truth leads to justice and peace. In other words, they're interconnected. They can't stand alone. Truth, peace, and justice are three pillars that are interconnected with each other.
I guess it depends on how you define truth. Because if you say something untrue, and then that is, by definition, untrue. If you say something that's not true, right, just A equals A. But is there a broader sense of the word truth?
And that's what we're about to read.
No. Okay.
In other words, in what situations is the truth not necessarily
the
truth.
The truth.
The truth.
Exactly.
Truth.
The true truth. So there's an interesting observation that according to most authorities, there is no direct biblical commandment to tell the truth. It doesn't exist in the Bible. There's no mitzvah, there's no commandment that says you should always tell the truth. It doesn't exist.
What about, we read the Ten Commandments one day, but it was early in the morning. There's no thou shalt not lie?
Nope.
That's right, there isn't.
Be a false witness.
That's right. That's what it was.
That's not. That's something else. That's in a court of law.
Huh. That's gonna make you feel better about my day already.
So one way of understanding it is, in essence, the Torah looks at truth as a character trait. In other words, it's meant to be it's part of the fundamental fabric of a human being, and ultimately, if you tell the truth when you're harming another person, that is considered to be false piety. And in essence, the Torah looks at that as a negative trait. So the Torah doesn't command us to always tell the truth, because that would be absolute. And in certain situations, we do not tell the truth. And we're about to read more about that.
Can you play, every time you say, and the life, and the Torah shall use the damage that I've done. Two things. Certain times I should not say anything. Other times I should not lie. Maybe what it meant is that if the truth hurts, don't say anything.
Or bend it. Sometimes you have to bend it. Sometimes saying nothing, it could be interpreted as as a yes or a no. So that's what we're about to read about. Let's, Irwin, text 11, page 103. By
it's only the cynic who claims to speak the truth at all times and in all places to all men in the same way, but who, in fact, develops nothing but a lifeless image of the truth. He dons the halo of the fanatical devotee of truth, who can make no allowances for human weaknesses, but in fact he is destroying the living truth between men. He wounds, shames, desecrates mystery, breaks confidence, betrays the community in which he lives.
So obviously, in a perfect world, we would live, the realities of life and would be synonymous with truth, and we would always be able to tell the truth because people would never interpret it or be hurt, but that would be in a perfect world. The fact is, we don't live in a perfect world. And being that we do not live in a perfect world, it would be, and oftentimes it is worse to always tell the truth than to sometimes bend the truth or hold back the truth. Let's read in section B, lying for the sake of peace. This is text 12. Really.
Rabbi Simon said, when God was about to create Adam, the angels on high divided into different camps. Some said he should not be created, others said he should be created. Kindness said, let him be created, for he will be generous and kind. Truth said, do not create him, for he will be full of lies. Righteousness said, create him, for he will do charity and righteousness. Peace said, do not create him, for he is full of conflict. So God took truth and threw it to the ground, and then created man.
So the question is, what happened to the objection of peace, right? They objected when it came to peace, and they objected when it came to truth. But ultimately, God only took truth and trampled on it. He didn't throw peace away. So there's an interesting explanation here, and that is that peace is only beyond the reach of a human society when it must be complemented by truth. Once truth is removed, peace becomes often more attainable. In other words, sometimes for the preservation of peace, you must remove the truth. Peace is fundamental to society, and truth is also fundamental. But sometimes, in order to attain peace, truth must be removed. there's a famous statement about Aaron, right? Aaron was one of the greatest biblical figures of all time. And they said that he would often lie if his lies would lead to bringing harmony between a husband and wife. He would lie. He would twist the truth. Because peace was the ultimate objective. And if that meant that he lied to a husband or to a wife in order that they should not, that they should come together or whatever, he would do that. Aaron. A great biblical figure. So, if the objective is peace, often truth becomes the sacrifice for the greater good.
What about a person thinks they're telling the truth, and another person thinks they're telling the truth, and they're two different things because they, from their life experience or whatever, their truths are different. I mean, they think it's the same. People's truth isn't the same.
Truths are often hard to decipher, and what you're saying is true. What you're saying is true.
Yeah, true.
You're saying something very true. The truth often is up for interpretation, but ultimately every person on their own has to decide. Again, you know, an ethical and moral society is based often upon people, individuals. It's based upon millions of individual people making decisions. And those decisions have to be made by the person themselves using what they know and making their best decision. So yeah, one person's truth can be interpreted differently by another, but every person has to make a decision based upon their best decision.
It seems to me that's where you get a lot of conflict, because this person thinks he's true and this person thinks he's true.
Right.
Yeah.
That's, it's not a perfect world.
No,
what did I miss?
Now he says an acceptable rule, an example. The person says to a mother, here's a banana for your baby.
That's an acceptable truth. What does that mean? That you're not feeding your baby? Oh. If your kid's a little too wild, you walk over and say, here's a banana for your baby. And just wait till that mother, what her response will be. You never know. You gotta be careful. Mothers are sometimes very good with responses. So the following is, especially when when it comes to their children. The following are examples. We're about to read examples from Jewish law of contexts in which one may lie to increase peaceful feelings. Okay? And here is text 13. Steve.
Oh, 13, okay. Our rabbis taught, how do we dance before the bride? What songs do the dancers sing while they dance? The Academy of Shammai says, they sing the praises of each bride as she is, i.e., the dancers only sing about the positive qualities with which the bride is endowed, avoiding anything untrue or exaggerating. The Academy of Hillel says, we treat every bride as if she is beautiful and sing for her. A beautiful and graceful bride, the sages of Shammai's Academy did to those of Hillel's, said to those of Hillel's, if she was lame or blind, do we say about her a beautiful and graceful bride? But the Torah states, keep far from a false matter. The sages of Hillel Academy said to those of Shammai's, according to your words, if someone has made a bad purchase in the marketplace, should one praise it in his eyes or criticize it in his eyes, you must say he should praise it in his eyes. From here the sages said a person's disposition towards people should always be congenial.
So what we see here is clearly, and this is what we just discussed before, I think Ellie brought it up, you have a difference of opinion, where Shammai says, look, you don't have to say the truth, but you also shouldn't lie. In other words, if you're dancing in front by a wedding and the bride is clearly not, she's not a model, then just don't say anything, right?
Don't tell her you're ugly.
In other words, be quiet. Whereas Hillel takes the exact opposite approach and says, no, if you're at a wedding, you must tell the bride how beautiful she is, even if she's not. Because he's saying that ultimately, if you don't do that, the husband will feel bad. You have to make the husband feel good. So his approach is a proactive approach. You must lie.
No, you
Well, that's the argument. We have both sides.
Because it'll create a positive energy.
Yeah.
She looks lovely in that dress. That means she has beauty or not a beauty.
In a manner of speaking, all brides are beautiful. It's a beautiful thing. You're not saying a lie.
And that's what Hillel is saying. Hillel is saying, look, you know.
There's something beautiful about her. Just say she's beautiful. And whatever it is beautiful about her. In so much as that is
right.
Beautiful, that you tell
and me. And ultimately, in Jewish law, we go according to Hillel. So Hillel is the defining factor. In other words, clearly you are allowed to lie if you are going to, if by not doing so, another person will feel bad.
I think the first thing a person says when you say beautiful, you think of the physical. But a person could be, you know, a great person and a great personality and be beautiful,
but then you
could be the ugly person in the world.
Exactly.
By saying you look, you say
right.
You look.
But I think we all get the point.
Yes.
Right? The point is that Jewish law clearly allows for lying in circumstances where a person will be harmed if you don't.
And actually encourages it in
encourages it in this scenario. Let's go to page 106, text 14a, Harry. And this goes back to the question that Ellie actually asked in the very beginning of this class. Are you allowed to withhold the truth from a dying person?
A person who is dying is told to confess.
And again, confess here is silently, right? Judaism does not allow for loud confession. The general idea is before a person dies, you, like we do on Yom Kippur, right? On Yom Kippur, you silently confess, and you ask for forgiveness for all the sins that you've done. Same idea as before a person dies, it's meant it's part of the dying procedure. You tell them to say it quietly to themselves. Let's go to text 14b.
In order to prevent breaking his heart, causing deterioration of the person's condition, and expediting the process of death, we tell him slash her, many confessed on their deathbed and then die in the end. In the merit of your repentance, you will live.
So we see that we try striking a balance. Balance between dealing with the truth and reality. However, in a situation, this is a person obviously that knows that they are on their last breath. However, if a person is not aware of that, and if you feel that by telling a person the truth, their situation will deteriorate, then it's different. Let's read text 14c on page 107.
It is clear that one may not disclose his full condition of the illness to a physically ill in order not to cause shock and to give hope so he could continue to pray. Even if the sword is resting on his neck, one should not keep up hope and prayer. And if the doctor determines that the person has cancer, one should refrain from disclosing the full diagnosis to the patient. Even if the parents demand of their child to disclose all the information, it is forbidden to do so. If there is a chance that it will generate despair or unnecessary anguish to the parents.
In other words, parents often turn to their children and say, what did the doctor really say? Tell me. So he's saying that, look, if you feel that it's going to put them in a bad situation, don't tell them. Don't tell them the truth. How, and we're going to quantify that in a second. Text 14D, and that's on page 107.
Not only is disclosing information is permitted, but also stating that the patient will get better, even if it is highly uncertain, making necessary the condition of the sick person required. Only permitted.
In other words, what he's saying here is that often by telling a person the truth, their situation will deteriorate and you are shortening their life. On the contrary, as scientists and doctors have many times proven, a person's state of mind in the healing process often is more important than everything else. A person in a positive frame of mind, even if they are critically sick, can sometimes come out of it if they are very positively focused on getting better. If you tell that person who has a very strong positive sense of mind that the doctor said you're going to die, it's possible that he'll die. So you tell him the doctor said there's hope and you will live, that person will continue fighting and they may get out of it. And it's happened many times. So obviously in situations like this, we're required to lie. However, at the same time, there is a recognition that under some circumstances, it is kinder to tell the hurtful truth. And that is in text 14e. In this situation, a person should tell the truth, even if it's hurtful. Whose turn? Laura, I think it's your turn.
If someone's in great pain and wishes to die, it is permitted to tell him the truth. And this is comfort to the patient. Likewise, if he's very old,
so obviously in a situation like this, Jewish law says, you know, as we mentioned three lessons ago, there's great pain, right? There's no mitzvah in a person living if they're in great, uncontrollable pain. And sometimes by telling him, look, the doctor said it's going to be over soon, that's a comfort. If a person wants to go, it's time for them to go. You tell them you're almost there, it could be a comfort. And in those situations, obviously, no matter how much it may hurt, or if a person's not afraid to go, or if a person wants to obviously make arrangements, then you tell the truth. Okay. Huh?
When we were discussing this, Ruby said that very thing what you just said.
Right.
What if a person wants to make arrangements and you're not giving them?
Okay, so then you're required to tell the truth. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I feel they should know.
They should know.
I think.
Under all circumstances?
Yeah, because, I mean, that doesn't mean they're going to die, because a lot of people, they're told they have 6 months and they're still alive.
Yeah, but actually, medical experts, right.
It just depends on the kind of person they are.
The medical experts have often proven that it's a person's state of mind that determines how they will fight something.
That's right, but yeah. I think they should know. That's my opinion.
Okay, section C. Lying should go against the grain of our personalities. So even, as I mentioned earlier, because Judaism places such a strong emphasis on truth, even in situations when we have to lie, it should be minimized. Because each telling of a lie, even when it's justified, ultimately, in a certain refined way, lends to the breakdown of our moral integrity, as we can see on text 15, page 108. So even when we must lie, it shouldn't be taken lightly. Who's turn?
Rob Fike would deliberately aggravate him. He would tell her, prepare me lentils. She would have said, prepare peas.
Can't be.
If he said, prepare me peas, she would have said, prepare lentils. When it's done, chaya?
Chia.
Chia. And some will be when his son Chia grew up and was relaying his father's request to his mother, he would reverse them to her so that his father would end up receiving exactly what he requested. Upon receiving the desired dish and not realizing Chia's subterfuge, Rob said to him, your mother has improved her way. So Chia replied to him, it was actually I who reversed your request to her. Rob replied to him, this bears out the popular saying, a child that comes from you will educate. I too should have thought this trick. However, you should not do this, for it says, they train their tongue to speak falsehood, striving to be an inquisitor.
In other words, obviously, Rob felt that his wife's, deliberately trying to make him angry wasn't a terrible threat to his family life, and he managed to live with it. But his son, by distorting the truth ultimately, he felt, will deteriorate his moral integrity. And he said, I'm able to live with lentils if I want peas, and I'm able to live with peas if I want lentils, right? But ultimately, I don't want you to lie on my behalf, because that destroys integrity. Okay. We're now going to go to section 5. And this is the extreme standard of truth in the context of justice. Everything we discussed till now is outside of a court of law. In other words, it's between people. And how a person must act responsibly in the context of a moral society. Now, what happens if suddenly you find yourself in a court of justice, and the truth may hurt somebody. However, the judge is exacting the truth from you, and you have just made an oath to only tell the truth. This is not the same scenario. So what happens in this situation? According to Judaism and according to Jewish understanding, ultimately, the exception would be in a court of law. Let's look at page 110, text 16a and b.
Do not pervert the judgment of your destitute person in his grievance. Distance yourself from falsehood.
And b.
From where is this arrived that the teacher tells the student, do you know about me that even if I would be given 100 minutes, I would not tell a lie? Now I am owed a minute by so-and-so, but I have only one witness to testify against him. That the student should not join the witness? The Torah states, distance yourself from falsehood. Is this law derived from the verse, distance yourself from falsehood? In such a case, the student would certainly be lying, since he did not witness the alleged lie. And the Merciful One states in his Torah, you shall not testify falsely against your fellow. Rather, this refers to a case where the teacher said to the student, I certainly have one witness. Come to court and stand there together with him, but do not say anything, for then you will not utter a falsehood. By standing with the witness, you will help give the impression that I have two witnesses to support my case. The debtor might therefore be prompted to admit the truth. Rashi. Even in such a case, it is prohibited for the student to obey because it is stated, distance yourself from falsehood. From where it is derived that if two litigants come for judgment, one dressed in rags and one wearing an exquisite garment worth 100 mas. We tell the well-dressed one, dress like him or dress him like you, so that the court will not be disposed of the well-dressed one. Rashi. The Torah states, distance yourself from falsehood. When litigants come before Rabba Bar Rahuna, he would say to them, remove your fine footwear and then go down to judgment. From where is it derived that one litigant should not clarify his case to the judge before his opponent arrives? A litigant who argues his case without his opponent being present will not feel ashamed about lying. The Torah states, distance yourself from falsehood.
So as we can see from this reading, that clearly when it comes to a court of justice, the rules change. Ultimately, truth must stand on its own when it comes to a court of justice. And we must avoid any situation that makes lying more possible. We must totally keep and isolate a court of justice from any type of changing of the truth. And now the question is, are you allowed to lie in a court of justice for the sake of justice, right? A judge's dishonesty for the sake of justice in section C. As you know, all legal systems, including the Jewish legal system, the purpose of a court of justice is to come to a fair resolution for the questions brought before it. Now, what happens if a judge feels that in order to come to this fair resolution, he must lie?
A judge must lie.
So, ultimately, Judaism says that the law is an instrument whose purpose is to reveal and realize divine order. That is the purpose of law. Let's look in text 17. Regina?
Do not cause perversion.
It's an odd statement. It doesn't say justice, it says the justice. In other words, it's referring to a divine element that must always remain persistent within a court of law. Now, the law, according to Judaism, is not merely a conduit to establish justice. The law is justice itself. So ultimately, the law is justice itself.
Law and order, it doesn't say law and justice.
That's a TV show.
No.
So law and order, I guess. Yeah. Well, I mean, law and order comes together. It's justice itself. So in other words, even if a judge feels, right, that lying would bring a true resolution, he's forbidden from doing it. And let me give you an example. We actually discussed this in a different course, I believe, last year. Very interesting case scenario brought in the Talmud. Mort loves this one. We had a long conversation about it last time. This is a situation where you have a capital punishment case, murder. Right? According to Jewish law, you must have at least 23 justices. So, the majority rules. Now, there's one exception. That is that if all 23 judges find the person guilty, this is considered to be when they have to do the case again? It's called a mistrial, and they have to start over.
That is considered a mistrial?
It's a mistrial. Jewish law.
It means that they all agree. Guilty.
Unanimous decision for guilt ultimately means, according to Judaism, that they didn't do due diligence, they didn't look into the case properly, because it's impossible that not one person would find merit.
I thought he was acquitted.
He is. He's acquitted. Sorry, you're right. He's acquitted. So now the question is what happens if 22 people, right? What happens if 22 judges have said that this person is guilty? The 23rd now feels that he's guilty as well. But he knows that if I say guilty, the man's going to walk. Should he lie and say he's innocent, even though he feels he's guilty?
No.
And that way, send him to his execution. And the answer is no, he can't do it. Because the law has to stand on its own. Every judge must represent what he feels is true, because that is ultimately revealing divine order. Conversely, what happens if 22 said that he's guilty, and this person actually feels that he's innocent, but he knows that if he says innocent, he's going to be executed. Should he say guilty so that the person will be freed?
No.
Same situation, right? He has to say that the person is innocent. Even though he knows that based upon his saying that the person is innocent, he will now be executed.
No exception.
He must tell the truth.
You know where the fallacy lies, man? In that it's all subject to the presumption they didn't do due diligence. There should be a review board to see if they did do due diligence. There's a verdict.
What happens if all 24 of them were in court presiding over another case, and guy walked up and killed somebody right in front of all the judges, and then those judges tried him?
Then they were all witnesses.
No, you can't. They would all be disqualified because they're witnesses. Uh-huh. They saw. Yeah. So as you can see, Judaism clearly says in a court of justice, ultimately the truth must prevail, even if you know that by telling the truth, what you feel that there will be
injustice,
you must still tell the truth, because we believe that you are revealing the divine order within the court of justice.
I think it's different.
So in
every other example, up until this point, where we're talking about in the court of law, it's always been where you're people interacting with each other. When you get into a court of law, it is different. And now it's
This is the final. This is where the road ends.
This is a dispute
end
between
of the
people,
road.
Or
exactly.
Or a dispute between society and a person. It's a dispute, and now you have to do it, and the truth has to stand on its own.
Ultimately, a judge has his role is to serve as a facilitator, and if a judge's role is to serve as a facilitator, and if he is the one that says if he's the one that lies, then ultimately society as a whole loses. Because he's a facilitator, and if he feels that this is the truth, he must say it, regardless of what the outcome will be. So now, let's go back to our case study, right? In light of everything we studied tonight, let's go back, huh?
Is this the law that if everybody says the person is guilty, he is in this trial?
He gets acquitted, an acquittal. Yeah.
When
doesn't he get acquitted if there's at least one person that says he's innocent? So now let's go back to our case study. We began this case in a situation where somebody writes that I am part of a 3-judge panel, and I feel that the other 2 judges are unlearned, and that I, according to Jewish law, if one of the 3 judges feels that he cannot judge accordingly, then they add another 2. And then if they have the same situation, they add, in other words, they're always keeping an odd number, but they expand the judicial base in order to allow more minds to deal with the problem. So he says, am I allowed to lie in order to force 2 more people to come on to this court, and thereby I hope we'll get a better resolution? So what do you think the answer is? Actually, he answered that he was allowed to lie. And I'll tell you, because the other 2 judges were unlearned. That was what his problem was.
Yeah, but aren't you supposed to believe that the system is going to work? That's why you have to always rule.
If the judges are qualified.
Well, but then it comes down to you can lie.
He
if
felt
you're making up in your mind that they're not.
Oh, so maybe then they'd have an arbitrary board who will come in and say, look, let's ask these guys a few questions and see what their knowledge is. If their knowledge is indeed deficient, then we have a problem in the court system. If there's a problem in the court system, then we have to fix it. However, if the judges are deemed to be proficient and are deemed to be outstanding people of moral character, then it wouldn't stand. But in that specific case scenario, he said that they should expand the judge base in order to try to get a more...
When they posed those questions in here, though, they didn't tell us that.
It did, it said.
He deemed the two judges incompetent.
He deemed them incompetent. Yeah.
Maybe he's incompetent. I mean, you know, he deemed it.
You're out of order.
Okay, let's go to section 6, reprise, a future of perfect truth. The Midrash tells us a very interesting statement. It says, there's a thing here, it's a very important, let's go back for a second, there's a very important point on the board. That is a lie to subvert the proper application of justice, okay, that would, on all circumstances, be forbidden. Like in the situation where with the 23 judges. But however, to lie to add more judges so justice can be applied, that's different. In other words, he's not lying to change the actual case. He's lying in order to get maybe to a situation where he feels justice will be better applied. And I believe there's a clear difference between the two.
That first case, they didn't say anything about him thinking that they were incompetent.
What did it
write? He just says that, I have a member of the group of 3 judges who are involved in arbitration. 2 members who are standing. My view differs from my other colleagues in this opinion. Thus, the majority of opinions seem to be leaning towards a position which I felt was utterly mistaken. I feel that by bringing more judges, the case will gain from him to the additional judges, hopefully leading to a just verdict. Is it right for me to be deceptive and to say that I don't have an answer in order to force the other members to invite 2 more judges? Didn't say anything about incompetence, just the fact that they disagreed with him.
So, well, the incompetence has to be part of this. Just a disagreement wouldn't work. In other words, the case itself, they obviously left that part out. But if that case were really about just a difference of agreement, he would be forbidden from lying.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay.
If it's about feeling that they're incompetent, and he's lying again, not to change justice, but just to get a what he feels would be a more apt judgment, then it would be okay. But just because people disagree with me, that wouldn't work. Because
okay.
That's the whole point. Judges disagree.
But he should have brought this point up before the whole thing started. He said, look, this law is incompetent. You cannot sit for this trial.
But
to wait, to find out that their opinion is different than his, and then say they're incompetent,
well,
doesn't look right.
Well, maybe he found out they were incompetent over the course of the trial. That's very possible. Before a person opens his mouth, you don't know they're incompetent.
You play a ball game, you don't stop to the ball game.
It's not fair.
Let's play it again.
I guess there has to be clear measure of incompetence.
The three of them could have listened to the entire case and kept their own notes. Then when they got together to deliberate together, he realized that they really weren't fine with the whole deck.
Again, it's right, it could be only his opinion. In that situation, we have to decide. I mean, I guess the rabbi who they brought this to would then have to come in and say, look, let's really make sure they're incompetent. Maybe they are competent. Maybe you're the incompetent one.
People assign those three rabbis, and then they pass judgment before the case. Now, during the case, you don't rejudge those people by one of the people who is involved in the case.
But I think the point ultimately is that the only time a judge, the only exception to the time when a judge can actually lie, is if he feels, again, not to affect the case itself. There's absolutely no situation where a judge can lie if that lie will affect the actual outcome of the case. The only time he can lie is to broaden the judges so that he can maybe get a more just hearing of the case. But if his lying will directly affect the case, it's forbidden. Right, yeah.
And I would say the minute you give people too much liberty in lying,
by adding two judges, they may come to the same outcome. There's no guaranteeing that by adding two more judges, they'll side with him.
Maybe
they may side against him again.
Afterwards, somebody would say, let's bring more judges. Those two were not so good.
Sometimes they do that. At some point, you have to stop. I agree with you. At some point.
Stop at the beginning.
When it gets to 23.
Also, it's him as well. I mean, he's not being just. He thinks everybody that goes in there.
Well, maybe after they bring the two up, and then he says, let's have another two, maybe they'll kick him out. Maybe at that point, they'll say, you know what? You have a nice day. Anyway, there's an interesting midrash that describes the fourth day of creation. And it says that the fourth day of creation is, on the fourth day of creation, this midrash says, the light from the first day of creation was hidden for a future date. And what is that a reference to? It's a reference to a time when truth will once again rise up and peace and truth will coexist. As we mentioned before, when God was creating the world, God had to take truth and throw it on the ground in order for peace to exist. We do believe that there will be a time when peace and truth will coexist. Let's look at page 113, text 8.
Same as page 104.
Page 104.
Lines
from the state of peace. Right, right. So let's read whose turn is it?
It went on.
Text 18.
It went on.
Continue.
It goes on. You look at the next page.
There's a continue. This is
they
left out the juicy part.
Rabbi Simon said, when God was about to create Adam, the angels on high divided into two different camps. Some said he should not be created. Others said he should be created. Kindness said, let him be created, for he will be generous and kind. Truth said, do not create him, for he will be full of lies. Righteousness said, create him, for he will do charity and righteousness. Peace said, do not create him, for he is full of conflict. So God took truth and threw it to the ground, and then he created man. The angels from on high said to God, Master of the universe, how can you denigrate your steel?
before God sealed his truth. The angel said, "Let truth rise from the earth." God accepted their words. Thus it is said in the book of Psalms, and truth shall stop from the earth.
So this is actually a reference to a future time. As we mentioned before, that truth is representative of God. Today we live in a world that is not perfect, and therefore the truth, the true representation of God, is not whole in this world. But nonetheless, we believe that there will be a time when the truth of God will be fully. Good night, Terry. When the truth of God will fully encompass the world, it will truly shine, and during that time, truth and peace will be able to coexist, and that is ultimately referred to, of course, as the Messianic era, a time of perfect harmony and unity, something that all of humanity must ultimately believe in and strive towards. Key points. One, at the heart of lying is duplicity, or the projecting of something other than that which is truly in one's heart or mind. Even when no malice is intended, such as in the case of flattery or lying to a child, the very act of lying is generally prescribed in Jewish tradition. Prohibited, it should be, right?
Yeah.
Bad mistake. Underlying the virtue of honesty is the mitzvah to emulate God. We are asked to replicate in our own lives the virtue of the essential divine quality of truth. Torah defines truth as that which is everlasting, a quality that ultimately describes only God. As such, it is the foundation of our world. Number three, truth benefits both society and individual. Lying undermines integrity and tangles the liar in a debilitating web. Torah, however, does not promote a mechanical model of truth as an essential feature of integrity. Truth is better served in certain situations through being hidden. And five, lying is permitted in select contexts, such as maintaining peace, preserving modesty and privacy, preventing evil people from causing harm, or maintaining necessary optimism in a critically ill patient. And finally, truth is the elixir of life, and therefore worth upholding to the greatest degree possible. Only in the times to come, however, will the world be sufficiently refined so that truth and peace can coexist in perfect harmony.